Ready when you are, sir.
May it please the court, Mark Gardner for appellant Ronald Johnson. Judge, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes if I could.
Yes, sir, 5 minutes.
This appeal raises what we believe is an issue of first impression and a narrow issue. Simply stated, it's whether under the statute, 19.2128B permits the court to impose multiple punishments for a single failure to appear, or whether it violates double jeopardy to do so. The facts are very straightforward. Mr. Johnson was charged as a result of a single incident with three felonies, a forgery of a check by altering a check written to him by a third party, uttering or attempting to utter that check, and attempted false pretenses, largely by false pretenses, by attempting to pass the check. He was given all three warrants at the same time. He was assigned a single date for a preliminary hearing, naturally, and he missed that date. It's undisputed that he did so with notice and did so willfully. After he missed that court date, he was indicted on three counts of failure to appear, and we filed our double jeopardy motion. It was argued, and the court overruled it, which we maintain as error. And I would suggest to your honors that the starting place for analysis from our position is that the statute is ambiguous in terms of whether the legislature intended to permit the imposition of multiple punishments for a single failure to appear. We maintain that the language is ambiguous and rely on, by analogy, the cases of AC and Baker, which we cited, which deal with firearms. In those cases, the court held that the phrase any felony or any firearm, was ambiguous in terms of whether that meant singular or plural. It's our position that in this statute, the failure to appear statute, the phrase a felony is equally ambiguous and does not give us clear guidance as to whether it stands for the proposition that multiple felonies missed in a single court appearance give rise to multiple punishments. If the court accepts that there is an ambiguity, then under the rules of statutory construction that we've cited, we believe the result has to be that it's not clearly communicated by the legislature that multiple punishments are appropriate and that a single punishment is, in fact, the appropriate penalty. I've thought about why this is an issue of first impression, why it comes up so late in the game, if you will, when failure to appear has obviously been a criminal statute on our books for many, many years. I don't have any authority for this. It's anecdotal. I would simply tell your honors that in my experience, it's not normally prosecuted in this manner. And I would suggest that had it been prosecuted routinely as multiple offenses, the court would have seen this issue long ago. Well, why hasn't it been prosecuted as multiple offenses? Simply stated, my position would be that a fair reading of the statute leads you to the immediate conclusion that we're talking about the act of failing to appear. If it occurs on a single court date, there's a single crime committed. It's creative. I suggest to try to bootstrap this into multiple penalties because there are multiple offenses charged, multiple warrants outstanding, but it's not warranted by the language of the statute. I feel compelled to address.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Gardner? If one of these had been a misdemeanor,
yes, sir,
and the others had been felonies, wouldn't you still have at least two? Or to make it easier for questions, suppose you had a felony and a misdemeanor, and then you had 10 felonies, no misdemeanors. With the felony and the misdemeanor, wouldn't you have two failures to appear? But under your argument for the 10 felonies, there'd only be one.
Well, actually, I would take the position that it's one failure to appear, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. And I would respectfully submit that the difference in the two sections of the statute are simply intended to create a punishment gradation. And that's logical. It's logical that the penalty for a failure to appear for a misdemeanor not be as severe as the penalty for a felony. And the wording is consistent, a misdemeanor, a felony. I would submit that it's one or the other, but not both.
The Commonwealth would have, even in the felony misdemeanor hypothetical I gave you, the Commonwealth would have to pick one.
That's the construction for which I would argue. I believe that's consistent with the way that it's written. And I believe it's, if the legislature intended otherwise, they've demonstrated that they know how to do so. There are multiple instances where the legislature has said this offense, for example, larceny with the intent to sell, this is a distinct and separate offense. There's no attempt to do that here. I know the Commonwealth argued both below and here that the phrase a felony is more more clearly definitive, if you will, than the phrase in the firearm statute, any felony. I simply don't agree with that. I'm not a linguistics expert, but I don't see how the two or one is any more definitive or clear in terms of giving notice to the defendant who's charged with the responsibility of appearing on a given date. I feel like I need to just mention briefly that this whole issue about multiple signatures. I'll start by saying I don't think that should be the controlling basis for this court's decision. But when the case was argued in circuit court, the trial judge brought up the footnote, which I consider dicta in the Hines case, which essentially stated that if a person signed multiple summons to appear, then that person could be convicted for multiple offenses, failing to appear even though there was a single trial date. First of all, there was no evidence in our trial court that there was more than one promise to appear. Secondly, the summons statute, which Hines was dealing with, is worded very differently than this failure to appear statute. I would ask your honors to take notice of the fact that there was only one recognizance form, one promise to appear in this case. But I would argue if the court is disinclined to consider that, since I did not raise that argument in the circuit court, the converse argument would apply. There was no evidence before the trial court that there was more than one promise to appear. So if the court feels that that issue of multiple promises versus one promise is important, on the record of this case, there's nothing to indicate that the defendant signed multiple promises to appear for this single preliminary hearing. I'll reserve unless there are questions.
Very well, that's fine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Uberman?
Good morning. May it please the court, David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. First, just to address the alleged ambiguity of the statute of 128B, I do not think this court should apply the doctrine of lenity because the statute is not ambiguous. And I think this case is distinguishable from AC in that, again, as Mr. Gardner mentioned, the statute in AC, which is the possession of a firearm by a felon, that's the shorthand we use, but the statute actually says that it's a felon in possession of any firearm, uses the term any. And this court, the Supreme Court, have held that that term was ambiguous there. There was no indirect pronoun, I guess to say, as there is in this case. I hate to use a term of grammar, but the fact was that in that case, the convicted felon had three firearms with him. And this court said, you know, that only supports one conviction under the statute because it says in possession of any firearm. So the fact of the matter is, you know, a convicted felon could be standing in the middle of an armory and he would still only be subject to one conviction under that statute. That is very much not the same as 128B, which provides that any person charged with a felony offense who willfully fails to appear before any court is required shall be guilty of a Class 6 felony. Had the legislature intended only to punish the act of failing to appear, it simply could have omitted that following language, who had also been charged with a felony offense, unquote. And subsection C, I think, sort of underscores that, which is the subsection that deals with misdemeanor. And it tracks exactly the language of B. And I do dispute, I don't want to misstate Mr. Gardner's argument, but in response to your question, Judge Beals, it almost seemed like he was saying the misdemeanor would be a lesser included offense of the felony, that in the case of someone charged with both felony and misdemeanor failure to appear, essentially the court would have to choose one or the other. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that these are separate subsections, and under Blockberger, there's certainly an element present in one that's not present in the other. Obviously, we're dealing with a different level of crime. And Johnson, frankly, does not deny the fact that he had noticed that the preliminary hearing related to three separate felonies, nor does he deny that his failure to appear was intentional. And in Hines versus Commonwealth, and I do not want to put too much water into that case because it is different. There, the defendant forged his brother's name five times. He was pulled over. He signed his brother's name five times on a summons. And this court back in 2003 held that, each of those summons was a written promise to appear. And your failure to show up, which is what happened in the case, on that one date, supported five different counts of failing to appear. But the wrinkle that's different there is that Code 19.2-74A3 governs the issuance of summonses, and it expressly provides that any person who willfully violates his written promise to appear. So, and then it refers the court, or the legislature refers the judiciary back to 128B, which is failure to appear. Obviously, in this case, 128B has no written promise to appear requirement. And I concede with Mr. Garner, I could not find any authority in our Commonwealth, so I agree that this is a question of first impression.
Do you have that same understanding that this is an issue of first impression in all likelihood because it's not usually prosecuted in this fashion?
I don't, Your Honor, but to be completely candid with the court, I'm not necessarily qualified to answer that. I don't have the anecdotal experience that Mr. Garner has, but my response would be that that's exactly it. It's anecdotal, and there's nothing in the record or otherwise to support it. Frankly, I think it came up in this case because of how things played out. And I think Mr. Garner mentioned this, but after his client had been charged with these check-related felonies, he absconded for about 6 months. By the time he was apprehended, unfortunately, the victim in the check-related cases has passed away, so the Commonwealth could not prosecute those original three felonies, so I assume they decided, basically, we're going to stick it to him in this case because there's no other way to do it, which is might be a good time to ask the court. If the court were so inclined to find in Mr. Garner's favor, that we would ask that it be remanded back for resentencing in the event that the court were to do that. But I think that it's come up in this case because simply the Commonwealth had no other avenue, and it felt as though Mr. Johnson would be receiving a windfall as a result of his poor conduct in absconding. I also, just briefly, I don't want to spend too much time on the procedural arguments, but I disagree. I do not think the court can take notice of the recognizance form that Mr. Johnson included in his brief. It was not a part of the record of this case below. As this court knows, appeals are decided based upon the contents of the record of the trial court, whether they're lacking or not, and this court cannot take notice of instruments or documents in other proceedings. And I appreciate that Mr. Johnson, asked this court to rely on Rule 2:201A, which says that the court can take judicial notice of a document that's capable of, quote, accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy cannot be questioned. But if that were the case, then this court could take judicial notice of any record in any circuit court case anywhere.
Well, on this point, if I recall, you've raised 5A18, saying there was no discussion about there being just one signature and one recognizance bond. But isn't the 5A18 is whether the issue, the assignment, the assigned error has been preserved, and the issue, the assigned error, is double jeopardy, and this is just one of the circumstances. So it really doesn't fit 5A18, does it?
Yes, sir. I want to answer that very carefully, and I think I may have phrased it poorly in my brief. What I intended to state was that because the court cannot take judicial notice of that recognizance document, and because that argument, which is Mr. Johnson's argument, I only signed one document, is premised entirely upon a piece of evidence that the trial court never had in front of it. That is why it's brought. Under normal circumstances, obviously, the appellant can raise whatever argument he wants to raise, and it's important. I'm certainly not challenging that here. I'm just saying it happens to be in this particular case, that argument is premised upon a piece of evidence that the court never had in front of it. So for that reason, it should be excluded. I still think if the court wishes to address that aspect, it could certainly get there in an opinion. But I think it's well settled in Bernea versus Nealon, the Virginia Supreme Court held that the court will not travel outside the record that's in front of it, and that includes the record of this court and then the trial court below, not collateral proceedings. And of course, the court's going to look at this de novo. It is an allegation of a double jeopardy violation, but the burden is on the defendant to establish that double jeopardy violation. And if the clause of double jeopardy that we are addressing in this case is multiple punishments for the same offense, or at least an allegation of that. And when considering multiple punishments for a single violation, the determining factor is the legislative intent. So we have to look at what the gravamen of the offense is. And again, I mentioned it when I first got up. I do believe that the statute is not ambiguous. It begins, any person charged with a felony offense who willfully fails to appear. Other jurisdictions have looked at this issue. I don't want to spend too much time on this because obviously this court is free to disregard or consider these opinions as it sees fit, but because both the parties spent a decent amount of time in their briefs discussing it, I would like to just briefly hit on those cases. In State versus Garvin, which is out of Connecticut, there the defendant failed to appear at his sentencing after he had agreed to a plea agreement disposing of a number of felonies. And Connecticut statute is very similar to ours in that it begins while charged with the commission of a felony. I won't bore the court with the rest of it. It just so happens that in Mr. Garvin's case, he had two bonds, each of which described one felony offense, rather than one bond describing two felony offenses. And the appellate court of Connecticut rejected a very similar argument to Mr. Johnson's argument today based upon double jeopardy, claiming that he could not be convicted of multiple counts of failing to appear for one single act, allegedly failing to appear. And they said that here there was one act of failure to appear on a given day, but two offenses, because each charge, of failure to appear involved an element that the other did not, namely being charged with the commission of separate felonies. And I think that's true in this case as well. And the on brief, and again, I won't cite all of it, but there's a particularly relevant decision out of 2009 from Wisconsin. It's the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, very similar facts. It was the case was in State versus Eagle Feathers, and the court considered whether a defendant who had been charged with two offenses, and was released on one bail could be convicted of what they termed bail jumping, two counts. And there the court expressly rejected Eagle Feather's argument that his two convictions violated double jeopardy and held that the existence of one bond rather than multiple bonds is a red herring. Said Eagle Feather's case turns on the fact that each count would require proof that the other did not. And again, this is a similar line that the Connecticut courts used in Garvin. And I think that same applies here. Regardless of the number of bonds that Mr. Johnson did or did not sign, I do want to just take a minute and say I do think there is sufficient evidence in the record for this court to find that certainly that Mr. Johnson was notified that he was due in court on three separate felonies on the date that he failed to appear, which again, not particularly relevant, but was June 20th, 2013. That he doesn't dispute that. He had noticed, he was aware of it, and he didn't show. He knew it was for three separate felonies. And it's the Commonwealth's argument that conduct supports three separate counts of failing to appear. And, for example, just to again distinguish the use of any versus a, in Robinson versus Commonwealth, which is a 1997 case from the Supreme Court of Virginia, there they held that the defendant's convictions for nine counts of contributing to the delinquency of a minor were appropriate when he held a party where nine minors were consuming alcohol. And that was because the statute said contributing to delinquency of a minor, not any minor. So I think there is, it's an important distinction, and I know it's grammatical, but it's just as important, I think, as whether something's in the disjunctive or the injunctive. It goes to the meaning of the legislature. And clearly, the legislature, for example, in the Hines case, the statute involved there, they used the express language, anyone who violates his written promise to appear. Well, they did not use that language in 128B. And as this court knows, when the legislature uses certain language in one aspect but not in the other, it intends the natural consequences of that action. So I think that there's a clear way to distinguish here. Well, I agree, at least anecdotally, it appears that this issue has not come up before. I certainly don't think that's a bar to the prosecution in this case. I think the decisions of the Wisconsin and Connecticut courts are persuasive. I think they're reasonable. Obviously, this court can take them or leave them as it sees fit, as it can do with the cases out of Washington, D.C. and Florida, which Mr. Johnson cites on appeal. Mr. Johnson's failure to appear, while it was a single act, it disrupted the administration of justice, and it disrupted the administration of justice with respect to all three felonies. In fact, it halted it because he was never prosecuted for any of those three felonies. I think those are three separate wrongs, each of which are deserving of three separate avenues of punishment. One pull of a trigger, which results in three injuries, would certainly support three counts of malicious wounding, even though there was, whatever it may be, especially given the last case that the court heard. But it's no defense to say that I only pulled the trigger once. And I think that same logic applies here. In Stevens, the Virginia Supreme Court held that two or more distinct and separate offenses may grow out of a single incident or occurrence, warning the prosecution and punishment of an offender for each. And I think the same is true here. With that being said, I thank the court for listening. And unless there are any questions, I'll rest on the remainder of argument as set forth on brief.
Hearing none, we thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
If I may, I started out by referencing this as a narrow issue. I don't think it goes too far to say that it's a fairly simple, straightforward issue. When considering multiple punishments for a single transaction, the controlling factor is legislative intent. If we all agree that Mr. Johnson's failure to appear for a single preliminary hearing in a single courtroom on a single date and time is the transaction at issue, and I think even the Commonwealth concedes that, then clearly all the case law indicates that the question is controlled by the legislative intent. That's why it's difficult to compare sometimes what other states have done, because their statutes are not worded identically to ours. If we focus on our statute, the question is there an ambiguity? Does the legislature clearly convey an intention that multiple punishments be imposed for the single failure to appear on a single date where there are more than one charge pending? And I respectfully submit that that issue has to be resolved in favor of the accused, and that's consistent with the language in the cases that have been cited. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel and thereafter.